Hi, welcome back to Bookish. My guest this week is Dr. Amanda Foreman. This was such a thrill to get to speak to her. She is the author of several books. One of them is Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, which was adapted into a film with Keira Knightley. It was a book I devoured. I remember reading it as soon as it came out and thinking how beautifully and elegantly written it was and how a piece of history need not be dry and desiccated and out of reach, but could be as lively and informative as that. Her second book, A World on Fire, An Epic History of Two Nations Divided, is about the role of the British in the American Civil War, which was a really interesting read. She's currently a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Her latest work is the BBC documentary series, The Ascent of Woman. And her book on the history of women, The World Made by Women, will be published this year. I cannot wait to read it. Our discussion was so much about women and the role of women and the female point of view and where that fits into both literature and history, and how literature and history have informed one another and where they differ. It was a really fascinating and provocative interview, this. I was so thrilled to do it. I was so grateful to her for making the time for me twice. I had to cancel once because I wasn't well. And sadly, we didn't get to do this face-to-face, but we did it as a FaceTime on the laptop, which was a new experience for me. And I'm really grateful to Amanda for enabling that and being willing to play along. I hope you guys enjoyed this one. I thought it was absolutely fascinating to listen to Amanda talk about her books. Amanda, thank you so much for doing this podcast. I am so delighted to have you on the this episode. I'm really thrilled. Thank you for agreeing to do it. I was just explaining to Amanda, this is my first try at doing a non-in-person interview, so everyone's going to bear with me if it feels less fluid than it does usually. Thank you for picking your books. Was it hard to pick your five formative books? Was it easy?
I found it very hard, actually. I'm not one of those people who has a favorite color or a favorite number or a favorite book. And so narrowing it down really was quite painful.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And I think it's, you know, it's why also I try and be really sort of explicit about it. They're not necessarily your favorites. They're the ones that shaped you. They're the ones that, you know, formed you in some interesting way that were pivotal for, you know, moments in your life or sort of emotional development. Did that help as a part of the remit, or was that still too wide a field to have to dive into?
No, that was enormously helpful, actually, because these books are books that made me think in various ways, which is different from, you know, the approach where, you know, you just loved a book and really enjoyed it because it was a page turner.
Right. Yeah. I find that the favorites also change so quickly, whereas the ones that I had my editor interview me for this and when I did season one, just to have an idea of what it was like to sit in the hot seat. And it was interesting because I found that there were three that were just immediate, absolutely non-negotiable. And in a way that had I been asked for my five favorites, would have been far more slippery and hard to, you know, hard to maintain, hard to unequivocally say, yes, that one, definitely. Because I find favorites shift so much according to where you are in your life or what you've just read or whatever.
I think that's absolutely right, that we are messy and complicated creatures and our tastes should change.
Yeah.
And how we feel about books should change if we're going to stay alive and current and engaged.
Yes. Yeah. Were you always a reader? Do you come from a reading family?
I very much come from a reading family. My father was a screenwriter. And so books and writing and being in creative industries was in our lifeblood. It was how we all, my brother and myself, he's also a writer, Jonathan, it was just part of who we are and who we were.
Did they read to you as is that a memory you have?
I don't remember, but I know they did. And it's very much like my own children. I don't think remember me reading to them, but you know, I know I did.
But evidence would suggest that you did. I read your father was blacklisted. That must have been a terrible time for him and your family. Is that right?
Well, it was a terrible time for him. I wasn't born at the time.
Oh, right.
I'm the product of a second marriage. So he was in his 50s when I was born. But it certainly shaped our lives. And I'm a product of that blacklisting. Mm. It was during the McCarthy period. Many filmmakers were blacklisted. Mm. My father was blacklisted because he refused to name names when he was subpoenaed to appear in Congress. Mm-hmm. He was perfectly happy to talk about his political affiliations and beliefs, but he refused to throw anyone else under the bus. Mm-hmm. He was able to leave the United States with hours to spare. He got on a boat and had his passport, and literally the next day his passport was revoked, and wow, he arrived in England as a political refugee.
Wow. How extraordinary. And did he continue writing from England, or was that possible? Was that something one could continue to do?
So when he first arrived, he discovered that the blacklisting had followed him across the Atlantic, mm, and he could only write anonymously. So he could be a ghostwriter for others. Mm. And the whole experience, though, had left him so angry that for 2 years he had writer's block.
Really?
Yeah, it just, that anger, that sense of betrayal consumed him. Mm. And I think it was a very difficult time, and it obviously led to the breakup of his marriage.
Mm, yeah, I'm sure. How fascinating. In fact, writer's block to me is so intriguing, because it seems to me this is not just a construct. This is an actual, meaning it's not just an abstraction. It seems to me something that actually happens, that there is a sort of neurological, psychological thing that happens that creates this huge insurmountable impediment. It's more than just, oh, I'm not feeling it today. That backs up my theory that writer's block is a real thing, that it's not just laziness.
I think it is a real thing. I remember after I finished making a documentary series on the history of women called The Ascent of Woman, for about 18 months afterwards, I wasn't able to work on the book that was meant to accompany the series.
Mm. Wow.
And and it was embarrassing. My publishers were cross. Mm. People were waiting for it, and I simply couldn't do it. Mm. And if I could have given my finger in order to get back to writing, I would have done it. Mm. And so it's funny how it can just happen. I think I was exhausted. I'd put so much into making the series. I had literally nothing left for a while.
Yeah, you'd already written it, essentially, within that. It was a four-parter for Netflix, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And yes, I had, to some extent, at least written half of it, but right, that half had taken so much out. And the filming of it had taken 26 weeks, which was a long time away from the family. I have five children. And the emotional toll it took on them, I think, made me feel so guilty that I couldn't work for months afterwards.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you read did you read in that time? Was that something that was comforting or debilitating or contributed to sort of moving through it?
I found myself doing a lot of gardening, actually.
Really?
Yes, that being outside and getting dirty and hot and sweaty and creating something that was artistic and beautiful, but also flexible and mutable, so that I could change it from day to day, and it was just incredibly healing. I did more gardening than I did reading.
Yeah, lovely. What a lovely meditative thing to do. I can understand. And also how nice not to have to intake anymore. There's no stimulus required from gardening, in the sense of more words or images on the page or anything. It's a calmer activity.
Yes, it really was. I think I was just mentally exhausted, and therefore to do something physical was very healing.
Yeah, I'm sure. Let's talk about your first book, the first one you gave me, and we can amend the order at any time if you'd like. This one I loved seeing on the list is A Little Princess by Frances Hodgson Burnett, which was published as a book in 1905, but was serialized between 1887 and 1888. When did you read this? How old were you?
I was around 8 or 9 when I first read it. Mm. And it was one of the first books that I read again and again and again. Mm. And what I absorbed from it was the message that grown-ups can be terrible people, and that it is up to the child herself to create a moral universe that she can live in and live with herself in, no matter what her external circumstances are. Mm. Which is a very sophisticated message.
I was going to say, you got that at 8 or 9.
Well, I mean, I don't mean that I myself was sophisticated, but that Burnett's message itself is a very sophisticated one, and sure. I think that she expected her readers to be able to absorb it in some way, perhaps not put it in so many words at that age, mm-hmm. but that's what she was saying, and it was incredibly empowering because it was telling young girls that even if they feel helpless in their own lives, or that the object of other people's designs or thoughts or desires, that doesn't necessarily or shouldn't mean that they should give up their internal sense of who they are.
That's such an interesting reading. I think for those that don't know the book, it's about a young girl called Sarah Crewe who starts off at this boarding school in England, and I'm going to just precis this badly, but arrives as a sort of little princess, and her father dies and she's quickly orphaned and relegated to the attic where she's made to go and live and sort of help work at the school. Is that right? I think that's right.
That's right, yes.
And then an interesting man moves in next door. I think he's Mr. Carrisford, I think. And he has an Indian servant called Ramdas who has a monkey. And the monkey creeps into Sarah's attic room. And she starts the relationship with the little monkey. And then by extension with Ramdas, the servant, and then with Mr. Carrisford, who takes pity on this orphan who's being mistreated in the attic and sends over little by little some sort of luxury items, and little by little she manages to furnish this attic and make it comfortable. It's never a replica of the enormous luxury that she had when she first arrived, but there are traces of the comforts that she used to have. And meanwhile, she, you know, manages to make the best of the situation and befriends other, even less fortunate children in the school, until at the very end, I think Mr. Carrisford adopts her, doesn't he? Or he discovers that he was somehow responsible for her father's death, or...
That's right. So there's this dual story going on, that on the other side of the wall of this school, which is this select seminary for young ladies, is Mr. Carrisford, who, by amazing coincidence, was her late father's business partner.
Oh, that's right.
And the two of them had a venture together in developing diamond mines in India. And unfortunately, there was a moment when it looked like the whole thing had fallen to pieces. Her father then had a nervous breakdown and died of quote-unquote brain fever, believing that he had lost everything. And because he was already a widower and died having had this nervous breakdown, nobody knew where he had deposited his daughter, what school she was in, even what country she was
in. That's right.
So when Mr. Carrisford then discovered that, in fact, the diamond mines were working fine, that it was not a disastrous business deal, and wanted to make amends and find Sarah Crewe, he couldn't. He didn't know, nobody knew where she had gone. And so he then spent the next few years looking for her, conducting the search, not realizing that the little orphan that he would see going out into the cold, cold snow, carrying her basket of provisions for the nasty, mean cook who beat her and bullied her, was really Sarah Crewe.
Yeah. But I love what you're saying about the message of to create one's own moral universe, and that that's what Sarah Crewe was doing in that attic. And I was so struck by, as a little girl, I read that book many times, although you clearly more often and praised it more succinctly than I did. But I was so struck by this idea of this miniature world that she made up there, that she had a retreat of her own. I think I, as an only child, related hugely to having a world that I had to populate, that I had to fill, that I, a sense of family that I had to make with my dolls or my little, you know, chip teacups or whatever. So that to me resonated. But I'm struck that you extend that to her needing to create a moral universe for herself too. And that seems to me a really interesting point of view. I don't think I'd thought of that before.
Well, I suppose that's when I was first encountered this idea that history is meaningful, because for Sarah Crewe, the way she creates this moral universe, where she's able to inhabit something other than her truly miserable conditions, is that she reads history books. And that's
interesting. I don't remember that detail at all.
Well, it's, yes, I suppose it's, you know, it's horses for courses and what
of
we
course,
can take.
Yes.
But, so there's a marvelous scene in the book where she recreates the idea that they're prisoners of the Bastille, and she tells these stories to her her friend, who's the other maidservant in the attic, about how the prisoners of the Bastille were able to survive, and they compare themselves to this, and they think about Marie Antoinette, and, you know, so they're for them, history is living history. It's lived history.
Mm.
And that's what helps them and her to keep going.
Mm.
That sense of connection.
Do you remember knowing what the Bastille was? Do you remember knowing about that?
No, I had no idea. I didn't know, you know, I was 8 or 9. I didn't really know anything other than there was something that she called the Bastille, and that there were these prisoners, and
right.
and it was, you know, set in history, and it seemed very exciting, you know.
Did you play history games as a kid? Was that anything you and your brother did?
Yes, my brother was a very precocious child, and so it was great fun growing up with him, because he really was and is a voracious reader. So the two of us had an extraordinary world going on at all times, I think.
Really? That must have been wonderful for your parents to see. I think particularly for your father as a storyteller, that must have been exciting. My husband's a screenwriter and I'm an actress, and nothing gives me greater pleasure than watching Billy, our 5-year-old, spin an enormous narrative out of nothing. It just, my heart blooms when I watch her. I feel like, oh, we're doing something right, that you know how to tell a story with that kind of success.
I totally agree with you. Among my children, the youngest are twins.
Mm.
And for years and years and years, they've had this ongoing imaginary game based around friend.
Because they haven't got enough in the family. Wow. Yeah,
you know, so the game of friend has its ups and its downs and its plot devices and whatever. And the rest of us, the other three children, and us, we just watch this, the game friend, unfold, and it's hilarious.
How old are the twins?
Well, they're now 10, about to go on to 11, and so they don't play it so much, but I mean, it was this enormous trope in our lives about playing friend.
Were others invited to play friend, or is it just private thing?
No, we could all join in and play friend too.
And does friend exist as a third entity? Is friend an actual person?
No, friend was the identity that you could assume, and then things happened to friend, or, you know, I mean, it was amazingly sort of simple and complicated at the same time.
The best ones. But I love the story of friend. That's so great. While we're still on Little Princess, did you like her other books? Were you a fan of Little Lord Fauntleroy or Secret Garden? Was it really Little Princess?
Yeah, I mean, I liked her other books too.
Mm.
I did find the Yorkshire dialect of The Secret Garden slightly irritating, to
yes.
be honest.
Yeah.
As a child, really having to stop and decode the accent.
What Dickens was ever saying.
It didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
When I became a mother and then read that book, Little Princess, to my own children, I actually found myself crying.
Did you?
In sympathy for the descriptions of Sarah Crewe's sufferings.
Yeah.
As a child, I you know, felt sorry for her, you know,
sure.
and always felt much happier at the end when everything
yes.
had worked out in a neat little bow. But as an adult, coming back to the book and then reading the description of the appalling abuse that this girl takes at the hands of that headmistress, headmistress's sister, the mean girls at the school, the staff who formerly waited on her, and now she waits on them, and the cook, the starvation, she goes to bed hungry most days, most weeks, she's wet, she's cold, she's filthy, she's no heat in her bedroom. The catalogue of horrors that this child goes through as a mother struck me so forcibly. I couldn't believe it was so terrible, actually.
I know. It's funny, isn't it, revisiting children's fiction, I find that. You can't believe the horror that you endured as a child reading that you skated over. But the best children's fiction is the darkest in my mind. It really is.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
As long as there's hope. I don't
yes.
think simply dark children's books work. And I mean, when I first read The Hunger Games, I was troubled by it. And I felt that the murder of the little girl in book one, which takes place during this competition, and these children have to fight to the death, and Katniss, the heroine, witnesses the violent killing of a child who I think is between the age of 10 or 8, 9, 10, 11. And I did wonder whether a line had been crossed in children's literature, a serious psychological line that had gone from insight entertainment to exploitation. Because pain and suffering is something that I think YA authors and children's authors should be very good at, and it is their way of messaging and relaying those aspects of the world to children in a manageable way. And I wasn't sure whether with Susan Collins that the idea and the execution of The Hunger Games has strayed from that point, and it's pandering to the baser motives of the world and exploiting them. And it was actually a new low in children's literature.
That's interesting. And where do you come down in the end on reflection? Are you still ambivalent? Or do you feel it was the inciting event that was required in order to unleash the trilogy?
I feel that it really depends on the age group that it's marketing at.
Yeah.
That, you know, for 15, 16-year-olds, there's a different set of parameters and moral parameters that go into writing. But I think this book is since marketed at 10 and 11-year-olds. That does trouble me. Yeah. I don't think that 10 and 11-year-olds, tweens, have the emotional and psychological maturity to handle those concepts yet. And it's simply inuring them to what is actually a shocking act, and making it by rendering it into a story where things basically end up okay in the very end, robbing the children of the importance of knowing that is a shocking act. That is not what happens in real life.
It's interesting. Yeah, I wonder. I'm with you. I think the inoculation against violence is a dangerous thing to fall into with children. Mine are much littler than yours. Mine are 5 and 3, and I'm struck by something everyone knows, but that every single Disney movie begins with these wretched children being orphaned. I mean, there just isn't one from Bambi onwards where the mother doesn't die. And I question that too. I find myself going, I don't know why they all, why does the shipwreck have to happen in Frozen? Why can't these girls just have slightly absent parents or remote parents? Why can't the parents have gone away and decided to rule another country? But I also, you know, then the storyteller in me goes, I get it. I get that there's an imperative here, and we have no stakes if we have the parents around. But I don't love the trope either.
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting question, because, you know, the death of the parent as a plot device, how close is that in modern storytelling to rape as a plot device, which we have, you know, modern television all the time?
All the time.
And so are we looking at something which is a psychological necessity, as, you know, Bruno Bettelheim would have argued, or any of the, you know, Freudian psychologists would have said, yes, but, you know, there's the child's greatest wish and fear that, you know, they lose their parents. And it's only by allowing them to self-actualize these fears through storytelling that they are able to process these violent thoughts that they themselves have and put them into a, you know, a better place.
Right.
Possibly.
Possibly. TBD. On a much gentler note, let's talk about your second book, Pride and Prejudice, which was published in 1813 by Jane Austen. Tell me why this is on your list.
Well, I read this as a teenager, and for any woman who reads that book in particular, I think what strikes a woman is that this character, the Eliza Bennett, is clearly the heroine of her own story. And that is actually in very short supply. That Eliza Bennett is a heroine in the sense that she's also the human in the story. She makes mistakes. She learns. She triumphs in the end. She grows as a character. And unlike most other set books that you have to read as a teenager, her encounters with men are interesting and important, but they don't change her. She changes herself. They don't teach her, she teaches herself. So when I read that book, it stayed with me, because as a teenager, I felt very disempowered. And this was a message of hope.
Why disempowered, do you think? Just is that standard for teenage years?
I think most teenagers do feel disempowered.
Close to adulthood, but not close enough to have it.
It's sort of, you know, the rite of passage.
Sure.
And I didn't become a writer. I didn't know I wanted to be a writer until I was in my 20s. And all through my life, until I started writing my first book in my mid-20s, I had this recurring dream. And it was so powerful and so strong that I just assumed that I would have it, A, for my entire life, and B, that it was a normal dream, that everyone else had this dream too.
What was it?
I would dream that I had something important to say, and at that moment, a number of things would happen. Either all my teeth would fall out, or my mouth would be stapled shut.
Wow.
Or I would start talking, and blood and gore and whatever would start coming out of my mouth, so I couldn't speak.
Wow.
And I just thought, well, that's just it's like a normal dream. Like,
yeah, normal, you fly, standard. You know. Wow. And did it stop when you started writing?
Yes, and I've never had it since.
Really?
It's extraordinary because it was so real and it was so terrible.
How amazing. And this was was Georgina, Duchess of Devonshire, that was your first book, is that?
That was my first book. And yeah. I started it as a PhD. And I was during when I was writing it as a PhD that, and I mean, and the book together, so I was in my mid-20s, that the dream stopped.
Wow. How extraordinary. And do you credit Pride and Prejudice as a book that gave you a sense of agency, something to sort of aim for as a young woman, of being someone who could speak out, whose mouth wasn't stapled shut, as it were?
That's right. She is someone who's able to find her voice. Mm. Wants to find her voice, is on a search to find her voice. Mm. There are, I believe, three aspects that divide men and women and have done for millennia. Mm. And that is the unequal division of agency, autonomy, and authority.
Mm. And write that down.
There's another thing that Jane Austen says in Persuasion, where she has the heroine Anne say to I believe her fiance, who comes back to as Henry, the sea captain. She says, you know, men have had the power of words on their side for centuries. Mm. And by depriving us of an education and a literary tradition of our own, you know, you've taken those words away from us. Mm. And it's one of the very few times that Jane Austen ever says anything explicit about the state of male-female relations or what it means to be a woman in the 18th century. Mm. Otherwise, everything is very oblique. Mm.
Have you always been conscious of your gender, if that's not too strange a question? Is that something you have you always felt your femaleness in the world?
Yes, I have. Mm. I felt that my education, my schooling was inferior to my brother's.
Did you?
And I really did. And it made me very angry that the low expectations that came with my education compared to the high expectations that went with his.
Fascinating.
Was terrible. I mean, I went to school in the 70s and I went to, you know, an 80s, and I went to perfectly good, nice girls' boarding schools in England. Mm-hmm. And it was perfectly acceptable for many of the girls then in my year, not to go to university, but to go to flower arranging school or secretarial college or, you know, whatever. And I don't dismiss any of those occupations because actually I love flower arranging and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm not knocking it, you know, and you can be a florist, you know, and make a, and be a, you know, it's a valid career. But the level of acceptance that what could be given to a girl that would make society or parents go bananas if it was given to a boy was in my face.
Interesting. So you then went to Sarah Lawrence, is that right, or Oxford?
I did.
Right.
I went to Sarah Lawrence first, which is this marvellous liberal arts college in New York State.
Sure.
And then I did my doctorate and master's at Oxford. Mm.
Did
with
that,
a little detour to Columbia.
Did that? Oh, just the worst institution. Sorry for that. Did that do anything to help redress the sense of parity or not? Did you...
Yes, it did.
Did it?
I arrived at Sarah Lawrence a very angry person. Mm. I felt like I had been let down and I felt hard done by. I had a sense of grievance, which I don't have anymore at all.
Yeah.
But I did at the time.
Yeah. Interesting.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Let's talk about your third book and where that fits into this. Your third book was Lord of the Rings, which I'm going to allow, even though it's a trilogy, unless you were specifying one of them, which is, of course, by J.R.R. Tolkien and was published between 1954 and 1955. When did you read this?
Well, I read it when I was at Sarah Lawrence.
You did? Uh-huh.
And, I mean, it says something about my education that I hadn't even heard of it. Mm. I didn't even know it existed until I went to Sarah Lawrence.
Who gave it to you?
A student who said, wait, you've never heard of Lord of the Rings?
Oh, really?
In fact, she was called Galadriel.
Great name. Was she in Lord of the Rings? It's an amazing name.
Yes, and she was named after one of the characters there. But Sarah Lawrence was this marvellous place where, I mean, there was another student who was called, and is now a writer actually, called Galaxy Craze. it was just a fantastic place to be.
Amazing.
But I laugh because Lord of the Rings is cited over and over again in most polls as one of the 10 best books ever written.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the book that intellectuals, when you ask them what they think, most like to dismiss and pan.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so beloved by quote-unquote ordinary people.
Right.
And therefore it's totally suspect.
Therefore must be inferior, yeah.
Yeah, it must be inferior, you know. But because I hadn't read it as a child and I read it as a college student, I feel like I came at it fresh.
Mm.
No one had shaped my views about what I should or shouldn't think about this book.
Mm.
And on reading it, it struck me that two things. Number one, the historicity of that tale. So although it's obviously, you know, it's fantasy, that Tolkien's absorption in Norse tales, Old English, Beowulf, with a tinge of James Fraser's The Golden Bough, that sense of the essential of what in this country you might call Joseph Campbell's Hero of the Thousand Faces, the sense of the kind of these, you know, mythologies that are the building blocks of many cultures and many civilizations that he wove into a kind of modern tale was really, I found it very moving. I suppose you could say that in every aspect of what I've been moved by, there's a sense of history.
Mm.
Or a sense of connection to the past and how it informs us and makes us and shapes us and is in our words, is in our appreciation of language, of art, of possibilities, of human frailties, of human success, of loss, tragedy, hope, continuation. And, you know, I mean, obviously there are lots of flaws in Lord of the Rings. I mean, there's essentially one woman who wants to be a man until she meets another man who makes her feel like a woman. You know, I mean, it's not perfect, certainly not how we judge these things today. But nevertheless, it's such a feat that to say that it's not an intellectual book is ridiculous. It is a very intellectual book.
I agree, yeah.
And he also managed to write, I mean, leaving aside some of the poetry, which is not my favourite stuff in that book, his descriptions, rather like what Alexander Dumas was able to do, and not every author can do this, that the descriptions themselves, and they're long, I mean, you know, endless descriptions of walking into the Vale of Mordor or whatever, you know, bring the narrative forward.
Mm.
That they're not simply there for the sake of a few pretty phrases.
Mm-hmm.
That every single sentence has a purpose, even when it's describing the shape of the trees.
Sure.
And not every writer can do that.
No. I agree. I think there's something when landscape and plot become fused, where the landscape is the story, I think is such an extraordinary thing to pull off, because an elegant turn of phrase about the shape of a tree is, I'm not going to say anyone can do it, but it's a little more achievable. But a turn of phrase where the shape of the tree informs your understanding of your lead character's frame of mind, or portends what awaits, or is embedded in a sense of urgency about what's happening in the plot, that to me, I wholeheartedly agree, I think is the hallmark of great, great literature. I really do.
And the other thing I would say about Lord of the Rings is there's something very classical about the way it deals with catharsis.
Mm.
So pity and fear.
Mm.
And that although he wasn't a classicist himself, there is that classical sense of pity, fear, and tragedy and how you make sense of these things in the course of everyday existence. I feel like a kind of a flavour of Herodotus or Thucydides, especially Thucydides in a funny way, with the Peloponnesian history, the Peloponnesian War, of that sense that these things happen and the humans who were involved in it, that as readers you can sympathise with them going off on a quest, whether it's to fight the Spartans or to get rid of the ring, that not all will survive. Others will suffer really tragic, awful deaths where they will be forgotten, dying in a cold field somewhere. No one's going to rescue them. Mm-hmm. And therefore, how do you make sense of that? Which is what the Athenians were asking. And it's what Tolkien is asking, is that in an epic battle or quest where survival is only going to be granted to the few, and many of those few won't be deserving. Mm. How do you make sense of it? Mm. What is this moral world that you live in? Mm-hmm. The other author who I think does this extremely well, and you may smile when I say that, is J.K. Rowling. And in particular, the penultimate book, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, in that what's interesting to me about that book is that the character of Snape, who has to kill the headmaster of Hogwarts, Dumbledore, commits an act which is very against his own interests. Mm. He's sacrificing his reputation in allowing himself to be seen as a traitor to the side of the good. And he does that. He loses his friends. He's with people that he actually despises, Voldemort and everyone else, for a higher purpose. And so it's a story about duty and sacrifice, and rather like the Longbottom characters who exist. So there's Neville Longbottom, who's the counterpart to Harry Potter, whose parents were destroyed by Voldemort, but they didn't die in a heroic fashion. They were simply destroyed protecting Harry.
Right.
And the only people who ever go and visit Neville Longbottom's brave and heroic parents are Neville and his grandmother, who live in poverty because nobody looks after them and there's no one bringing any money. And it's that is a very subtle, very important, extremely moral message that runs through this book. And at the end, Snape is killed protecting Harry. And only then does Harry realize how heroic Snape has been.
Right.
So for me, you know, Thucydides, Tolkien, there's a through line.
Yeah, it's lovely. I love that, and I love hearing that, because I feel the same way about J.K. Rowling. I think those books are extraordinary. I read them when they came out with no children to read them to, and really no excuse other than just fascination. I think I pretended to be reading them to my little brother, but I wasn't. I just devoured them on my own. And I remember too feeling far less articulately that there was a continuum, that this belonged in the path of great literature, not just children's literature, but there was a direct relationship between this and, what am I talking about? The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. I was kept thinking wardrobe. I couldn't get the other nouns in there. And also with Greek mythology, there felt like this world where you step through and everything is slightly off, and yet it has the entire moral universe of it is intact. That the center of gravity might be different, but everything else is contiguous with that new center of gravity, that nothing else has shifted. And that, I think, replicates to a degree what it is to be a child, that you are in your own little center of gravity, the center of which is you, and you're aware that there's a larger one that the adults are living in, which is quite separate to yours, and the needs and the priorities of that world are not yours. And yet somehow these two worlds have to coexist at the same time, and these needs have to be sort of meted out, and maybe yours will have to be sacrificed to your parents or to the sort of adult world. It seems to me there's a, consciously or not, but I think that's partly why it chimed, at least with me as a child or as an emerging adult, was this sense of the conflict between my immediate interests and the larger ones of a world I wasn't fully in yet as a grown up.
Yes, I agree. That's nicely put.
Let's talk about your next book, which is, I had been about to say how interesting earlier when we were talking about Pride and Prejudice that all your authors had been women, but then they're not, because of Tolkien, who didn't have a woman in his book, or had one, as you say. Let's talk about your next book, Britain's Forging the Nation, which was published in 1992 by Linda Colley.
Colley.
Tell me about this. I was fascinated reading about this. I hadn't heard of this book.
Well, this book and the next book we're going to talk about, I read when I was a student. And when I had originally gone to university, I had thought that perhaps I might want to read philosophy and go into philosophy. And Linda Colley's book, Forging the Nation, is a masterwork of its kind. She asked the question, how did this small island of very distinct provinces, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, England, come together after 1704, not just politically, but also in terms of its national identity? And she wrote a kind of history that is still totally modern today. It is 360 history. So it wasn't simply political. She also used cartoons. It's cultural. She uses paintings. She quotes from songs. It's a way of writing. It's a way of imagining lived history alongside intellectual history. You know, those that can do it well, and she is a master at it. It's inspiring, and it made me want to become a historian.
Oh, interesting. And
it really did, and it made me ask questions. So even if I didn't agree with every one of her conclusions, nevertheless, it showed me that there was a completely different way of asking questions about history, and that what might be enlightening to one set of historians is completely different from what's enlightening to another set of historians. And because I believe that, I think partly because she's a woman historian, she was able to do without shoehorning it in, to look at the role that women played in history and in the role of forging British identity. And one of the most interesting aspects that she did identify was how women, having been excluded from the inner political arena in Parliament, they're not able to take part in political debates, they can't vote, they can't pass legislation. So they developed an outside moral voice through campaigning. So when the question of the slave trade came up in the 1790s, it was women who took that campaign public and organised the first boycott in the world, the sugar boycott. And that sugar boycott forced the West Indian MPs and slave traders to the table.
Wow.
Because, yeah, I mean, and that was women doing that.
I didn't know that. That's wonderful.
I know, it's a marvellous thing. And these women in the 18th century set the whole tenor and shape of how you get this Victorian ideal in the 19th century of what does the angel in the home do? She is the moral arbiter of both the family and the heart of the nation. But it's satirised by Dickens as Mrs. Jellyby in Bleak House, but nevertheless, the woman who has the beating conscience and consciousness that she, by uniting with others, can change the way society behaves, whether it's slavery, emancipation, education, children, working in the mines, you name it.
And did you find that not only this was a book that asked history questions in a different way, but it was also answering those questions in a different way?
Absolutely. Also, she's a beautiful writer. She is a craftsman.
Right.
And so she taught me that if I wanted to write history, I could write as I wanted to write, that sentences matter.
Yes.
Entertainment matters.
Yes.
And that it was the first time I really saw that marriage between a book written for the wider public with blue chip ideas and masterful execution.
How wonderful. I think that's an exact description of your work too. So how lovely that you found it.
Thank you.
Tell me about your next book, which is In a Different Voice, Psychological Theory and Women's Development, published in 1982 by Carol Gilligan. I was fascinated reading about this too. Tell me when you came to this book. I love, one of the things that I read was the quote that said, "The little book that started a revolution," which I just thought was as good a cover blurb as you could hope for as an author.
Yes, that's right. So Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice. I also read this as a student. And it went hand in hand with how I felt about Linda Colley's book, that this too is a book that's written for the public, and yet it's incredibly profound. And I suppose those two books shaped my career in that I emerged believing that there is no idea that is too difficult that it can't be explained to the widest possible audience. There's nothing secret in the academy that can't be shared or debated and made part of the general conversation. And if it's not, it's the fault of the writer, the academic who wants to share or engage in those ideas. It isn't the fault of the public.
Right. Interesting. What was it about that her book? What in hers particularly was it? Talk to me about the book, about what it was in that that spoke to you particularly.
So apart from its execution, what's important and interesting about Carol Gilligan's book is that she isn't afraid to highlight the difficult subject, which is that do men and women think differently? And if they think differently, how does that impact the fundamental structure of society, which is, you know, how do we all get along with each other? And you can call that justice, you can call that law, you can call that morality. But essentially, it is, how do you go from the one to the many? Now, I don't agree with everything that Carol Gilligan says about how little girls and little boys make their moral choices and how they're formed. Nevertheless, even if you don't agree with her in totality, there are some, I believe, essential truths that she highlighted and pinpointed, which is the way, for example, that the emphasis we put on girls to connect has a huge impact on the way they perceive what their moral choices are and should be. So that for boys growing up, they are encouraged to compete, which means setting up hierarchies, which means that they are encouraged to keep their emotions out of the game that they are playing because it's about winning. And if you lose, you have to deal with it. And if it doesn't matter how the other person feels about losing, for example. Whereas for girls, if it's about making sure that everyone is included or everyone's feelings is, these feelings are being nurtured or not being hurt, that they are nurturing those around them, then their moral choices aren't going to be about hierarchies. They're going to be about what's best for everyone. And the example that Carol Gilligan gave is the dilemma of the man who needs to obtain medicine for his sick wife. He can't afford to buy it. Should he steal it or not? And when this question apparently was posed to these girls and boys, the boys would either say, well, stealing is wrong. No, he shouldn't. Or perhaps they might say, even though stealing is wrong, saving a life is more important. So yes, he should. But the girls would say, well, it depends. How sick is the wife? Could you go and maybe talk to the druggist first? And this was seen as a way of girls just simply not being able to understand what a moral choice is.
Interesting.
Yes. And which is, no, they completely understand what that moral choice is. But they partly through, you could say it's conditioning or just how females have an approach to certain life choices, they refuse to be put into that box. But where you take that argument is key. So, for example, if you take that argument at face value, then you'll say women are emotional, men are rational.
Right.
Women feel, men think.
Right.
So for me, the Carol Gilligan book raised 1,000 questions.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, they don't need to be answered. It's just the asking that is important.
It's interesting because you've got 5 children, so you have many more experiences with this. But as a mother of one of each, I see it all the time in that, just to expand on what you were saying, I think my daughter lives in a horizontal world and my son lives in a vertical one. And I don't think we have a particularly gendered approach to our parenting, but Billy, from the age of 2, has wanted a pink dress and a wand and a unicorn to ride and glitter. I'm not much of a glitter girl myself, so this is something she has arrived at all by herself. And my son wants to know who's older and who's younger than him all the time. That's an important thing for him to know. And he's 3 and he's already ageist, which is really troubling. But these are things that they arrived with this. This is in them. And I look for ways to make him more horizontal and her to stand more vertically. And I think, I feel like that's sort of the best one can do is you're working with a status quo that you hope has some elasticity to it and that you can widen them into a bigger worldview and an understanding that there are options and there are other ways to be, that Jakey can fall over and be sad and upset and come and ask for a hug and then keep running or keep competing, or that he can win and still turn around and look back and go, but Bubby's sad, let me go and give her a hug. You know, that's the sort of ideal, I guess. I don't know, I'm intrigued by the book, by the Carol Gilligan book now. It makes me want to go and read it.
Well, I think you raise a very important point. And it's simplistic to say that biology is destiny. Because, I mean, that's like saying that your DNA is destiny. And if that were the case, then why do we bother trying, you know, right, in anything? However, it's a fact that women have more oxytocin than men. Mm. And what is this hormone, oxytocin? Well, we call it the tend and befriend hormone. Mm. And it's a fact that, you know, when we give birth, that is the hormone that is released, which ensures that no matter how badly we feel, we have this overwhelming urge to look after the baby that's just been handed to us, mm-hmm, which we didn't have a minute ago. Now we have it. Right. And now we love it. And now we want to feed it.
Right.
And that in a dangerous situation where, you know, life is at stake, adrenaline will spike in men and oxytocin will spike in women. They that is why they will go against a crowd to go and find a child. Even if the crowd is, you know, going to mow them down, they will fight back and whatever. I mean, these are just observable traits that happen.
Sure.
And Charles Darwin wasn't completely wrong. In fact, he wasn't wrong at all. and you look at their differences. The point is not that we have sexual differences, because we do. The point is, what do you do with them? Mm. That's the key thing here.
Right.
There's been a tendency in the last few years to deny that there is something known as the female experience or the male experience. And that is a mistake, because puberty, menstruation, menopause, not everyone goes through childbirth, but those who do, those are primal experiences that are genetic. And together they make the sum of what the female experience can be in its many shades.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with the external sexual parts or sexual organs that we have.
Sure.
You can add or subtract them, but that is the essential experience of being female.
Yeah. Is this what your new book is about?
My new book is a history of women, because it literally goes back 3 million years. It's a global history of women.
Tiny subject.
It's taking me so long.
Tiny subject. Can't think why you've taken so long over it.
Oh, I know, it's been very hard. But I really felt that the silencing of women begins with a lack of our own story. Hmm. If you can't speak your story, you can't speak with your own voice. Hmm. So I feel it's now my mission, my purpose, is to write this book as a single volume in a way that anyone can get something out of. Because until we can have a narrative of ourselves that is really blue chip history, then we are at the mercy of those who want to give us a narrative, whether or not it's true, whether or not it's empowering. So that means looking at, for example, the 2 millennia before the Greeks and the Romans, because I think that most women believe that before the birth of classical civilization, there were just some hairy men driving around in chariots, you know, and that women
sounds
didn't really
right.
do anything.
Yeah.
Is that true? Now, I touched on it a bit in the series, and we looked at Enheduanna, the first named writer in history, who wrote in 2300 BC.
Wow.
And named herself and said, you know, I am Enheduanna. This has never been done before. And she developed that concept. I feel. I am writing.
I exist.
I exist. And to know that a woman did this, which is just a lovely thing to know that we contributed to history, because we've always been told that we didn't.
Right.
and then to have that statement of not just I am, but a kind of female I am is important.
Yeah, very much so. Imperative. And in this climate, more than ever, I think. What a wonderful, wonderful time to be writing this book.
It really is. I just wish I could. I was faster at it. Unfortunately, I'm the kind of writer that takes a day to write a paragraph. I wish I wasn't that person. I wish I was somebody else.
I think I think it pays off, Amanda. I really do. Take the day. Take the day you need. We need the book, and we need the book that you're writing. So I say take the time you need to take.
Thank you.
If you could, impossible question, if you could only take one book to your desert island, it could be one of these five or it could be another, which book would it be?
Well, I always used to say it would be Lord of the Rings.
Hmm.
Because by the time I'd got to the end, I would have forgotten the beginning.
Yeah. So are you still saying that? Is that still your book?
Yeah, for now I'm happy to take that.
Yeah. I have to read it. I've only ever read The Hobbit. I have it sitting on a shelf reproaching me for years and years, but I think maybe time. I've always thought it was too dry, but maybe this reawoken my interest in it, I have to say.
Well, when you have a cold and you're confined to your bed, I think that's a good time to give you some leisure time.
I am never confined to my bed with the two children on top of me. There's no reading Lord of the Rings while I still have these little ones.
That's true.
Maybe I'll read it to them one day. Thank you so, so much for doing the podcast. This was such a pleasure and a privilege. It really was. Thank you for taking the time.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Not at all. Thank you. Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you like the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website, bookishwithsonyawalger.com, if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the five favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Walger page. You can find us on Twitter with @BookishSonia or @SoniaWalger.com. And you could also email me through the info@BookishWithSoniaWalger.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from, or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.